Good morning and welcome to the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. I am your host, Joseph Childs, and you are listening to WDRT 919 FM, Radio from the Driftless. You can find this episode of the Crawford Stewardship Podcast online at WDRT.org, along with many other great podcasts and archival episodes. Today, we're sitting down with Dylan Bruce, co-founder, owner, and producer for Driftless Seed Supply just outside of Viroqua, Wisconsin. And we're going to talk a little bit about gardening and what the impact of a local farm business has on the community. So, Dylan, if you want to introduce yourself and maybe just give us a short background on Driftless Seed Supply and how you came about, starting a farm that is honestly, I don't think about that when I think of farming. I don't think of who supplies the seeds. So that's kind of a cool niche that you've got.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Joseph. It's a pleasure to be back on the show and talk about seeds and garden planning again. I started my farm with my wife in 2018, and we started as a fresh market farm, so running a community-supported agriculture program, selling to restaurants and farmers markets. And in the same year, we also started doing contract seed production as a sort of secondary enterprise. And so what that means is we were contracted by other seed companies to grow seed for them. And I think you're right. People often don't think about where their seed comes from, even when there are folks who are, you know, would consider themselves farm-to-table consumers or really want to know where their food comes from. They don't think about where that starts with the seed. And that's sort of by design in a way, because as the seed industry has become more consolidated, it's become much less transparent. And historically, in each county and in each state, there would be many, many small independent seed companies. But over the course of industrialization, globalization, and consolidation in the late 19th and 20th centuries, we saw a lot of those seed companies get, you know, bought out, merge, until now in Wisconsin, we basically have one historical seed company left, and that's Jung's, that, originated at that same time. And now in the commodity seed industry, we essentially have three players that control, you know, upwards of 60% of the intellectual property in seeds. In some cases, in some industries, it's even more consolidated. For example, Bayer controls about 80% of cotton genetics. So vegetables and specialty crops in general are not quite so consolidated, but still we've seen a lot of, you know, independent seed companies be bought out. And the medium seed companies getting bigger or getting bought out by the real big ones. However, a little bright spot is that there's a little bit of a U-shaped trend in the sense that in the last 15, 20 years or so, there have been quite a few sort of micro or regional seed companies, independent seed companies started up. And those are the types of companies that contracted with growers like me back in 2018 when I started my journey of seed production. And after about 5 years of farming, I decided I wanted to not have an off-farm job, just farm full-time. We were looking at our financials and realizing we would have to sort of double our fresh market production. And rather than doing that, we decided to go all in on seed because it was a little bit more interesting horticulturally for me, and I enjoy the production a little bit more. People don't realize that, you know, a small salad radish, like a cherry bell radish, when you're producing this it to eat for the table, takes, you know, 21, 28 days, something like that, to harvest it. When you're producing it for seed, it goes from this tiny little radish into a giant 3 foot by 5 foot high bush covered with flowers and swarmed with pollinators, and it takes more like 80 to 100 days to produce the crop. And so in a lot of cases like that, producing seed is a totally different and fun experience, and I would encourage people to try out some seed saving in their garden too.
I have, I don't know if it makes me a good gardener or probably a bad one, but I have definitely seen those kind of radish plants and many other plants where I go, oh my gosh, I did not know that they could get this big just because I didn't get around to harvesting it. So it is cool to see, you know, stuff that you you don't really think of, you know, this little tiny radish that's maybe 8 inches tall, and then all of a sudden you've got this massive bush. So you talked about making that transition. And so instead of being, is your contract seed growing still, like how did that morph into Driftless Seed Supply itself? Because now you're your own standalone seed supplying company. You're not growing seed and then having someone else's name be put on that, correct?
Well, we still do quite a bit of that type of contract production for other seed companies, but we also decided to launch our own brand in 2023 because we wanted to create a catalog, if you will, of products that was really tailored specifically to the Midwest production, because a lot of those smaller independent seed companies that I mentioned that have been starting up are based in the Pacific Northwest or in the Northeast. And, you know, a lot of those folks are the ones that would still contract with small growers like myself. But there's, with the exception of a handful of small companies that focus more on heirlooms, there really wasn't any players in the Midwest that were doing what we wanted to do, which is to get seed racks out in the community. Because, you know, we looked at this sort of small pool of Midwest seed producers and really were motivated to work as a team. And instead of competing with our peers for the same small piece of the pie of online sales, we wanted to compete with those bigger seed companies that I mentioned, the ones that you might see in, you know, Home Depot or the like.
So you said that there's not a whole lot of seed growers located here in the Midwest. Well, what does it matter that, you know, if you're buying seed from someone that's producing in the Northwest, if you're buying from a small producer, isn't that great? You know, what's the difference between buying from a large company that maybe is based in the South versus you know, your company or other companies like it that are based in the place where the seed is going to be grown?
Yeah, so I'll start with, you know, the larger seed companies. And when you're buying a packet, you know, some people are shopping for their seeds based on price, and that's not the niche that we're trying to fill. We're not trying to be as cheap as possible because we want to pay our seed producers as well as possible so that it's really a viable occupation. And those big seed companies, often their seed is, you know, for certain crops like cucurbits, so that's squash, cucumbers, things like that. That seed is usually produced overseas in China to take advantage of cheap skilled hand labor, or other places in Southeast Asia. Increasingly, some seed production is done in Africa, but, you know, people don't realize that seed is coming from overseas. And then for other crops, things like broccoli or spinach, it's done on a really large scale in Arizona or in the Pacific Northwest, where they're combining fields of it. And so what that does is it means that when the production is so far away in the supply chain from the grower who is buying that packet of seeds and planting it, it means that there's kind of a lack of selection on the crop, and it might not be true to type, and there might be some quality control issues. So people, you know, famously sometimes have, you know, bought pepper plants at big box stores that turn out to not be what it's advertised. And that's likely because it was cross-pollinated or the wrong seed lot got mixed in or something like that. And so we, and companies our size, you know, we get eyes on every single plant during the production, and we're taking and harvesting that seed and packing it into the packets. And so we are motivated to make sure the right thing is going in there, and are trying to be responsive to our customers that way. Now, because the seed is produced generation after generation overseas or in the Southwest in a, you know, arid climate that makes it easy to produce seed, but that's not the climate we're growing in. We have challenges like high humidity, precipitation, extreme weather events, that
negative
kind of thing.
Negative 20-degree weather.
Negative 20-degree weather, which is the perfect time to be thinking about garden planning and spending some sunny, peaceful days in the garden. But, you know, what happens is that the seeds become adapted to those environments over time. There's selective pressure to adapt to that arid climate, and the ones that are most adapted produce the most seeds. And, you know, year after year doing that means that it's going to be adapted for those other climates. Producing seed in the Midwest or in similar climates means that it's adapted to our climate. And so, for instance, you know, we've worked on, adapting a peanut. And people don't think about growing peanuts in the Midwest, right? That's not typical. But my business partner has been growing this line of peanuts for 6 years in the Midwest. And over the course of that time, has been able to select for better production, shorter seasons. So when people are selecting their seeds or choosing a seed company from the Midwest, they should be thinking about things like disease resistance, pest resistance, shorter maturity times, because, you know, we have a relatively short window of frost-free days and of hot weather. And so it can be hard to, you know, grow some of the longer season hot peppers, for instance. And so it's great to support those other small companies outside of the Midwest, and in particular, ones that are based in sort of coastal Oregon, where they have really cool summers, even though they have longer frost-free windows than we do because of their even cooler summers. They're often pretty well adapted to the Midwest, and similar for some of the seed companies based up in Washington, as well as ones based out in Maine or Vermont.
So it really is important, not just from a standpoint of I want to support smaller scale producers, but I want to grow a plant that is going to produce in the area that I live. You know, if it's great if you've got a plant that is growing in the equator and can grow, you know, 200-pound pumpkins in 60 days or whatever, but if it doesn't do it in the Midwest, then it doesn't matter to me because I'm the one growing it here in the Midwest. So I think that's a great point that I never thought of when growing a garden. That's tomato seed. All right, I picked that up. That's onions. That's, you know, I just buy it because it says that's what the vegetable is.
Right, and we have different pests, different diseases that we deal with here than in the South or the East Coast and things. And so the other thing is that the growing instructions that come along with those packets are often not going to be tailored to our environment. So we have, suggested planting spacings or timings that are typically less crowded, less tight spacing, because in the Midwest, maintaining airflow in your garden is really, really important for reducing disease pressure. And we typically recommend planting later than a lot of companies might recommend, because they're trying to paint broad brush strokes for, you know, maybe the entire U.S. market, versus companies like us, or like Nature and Nurture Seeds based in Michigan, or North Circle Seeds based in Minnesota, that really have a focus on our region.
So you mentioned earlier about, you know, we've been talking about the product here, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about the company itself. And you had mentioned earlier that you're not targeting the folks that are out looking for the cheapest seed available. And I did buy, full disclosure, I did buy about $60, $60 to $70 worth of Driftless Seed Supply seeds last year, and I probably still have half of them left, and I still grew a ton of food, way more than $60 worth of food. So even though it is a little bit more expensive, you're not losing money on this. And so I wanted to talk a little bit, when you talked about your produce, you said we like to pay our producers. So can you talk a little bit more about the business and your supply chain? Who are your producers? Is it just you doing this on the farm, or is there a little web of farms that you're supporting?
Yeah, absolutely. So we grow quite a bit of our seed between myself and my business partner. We have two farms. He farms in southeast Minnesota, and of course I'm here in southwest Wisconsin. We grow a lot of our seed, but we also have maybe up to a couple dozen small farms throughout the Midwest that will grow seed for us now. And it's sort of a mix of folks who maybe look at it as a big hobby, just really like seed saving, and have discovered, oh, there's actually an opportunity for me to produce a commercial amount of seed and make a little money off of it. Or fresh market farms that look at it as a different enterprise, like I did when we started. And so, you know, an example of a couple of those might be Blue Barrel Produce that's based in Cuba City. in southwest Wisconsin here, or Cattail Organics up in Athens. And both of those, you know, mostly they're growing fresh market produce, but they also grow seed for us. And that has come out of a love that those particular growers have for thinking about the supply chain from seed to seed and growing for seed. They grow more and more varieties for us. And we, part of our mission is to educate people about growing seed and to increase the pool of Midwest seed growers, because that's a foundational part of our food security in the Midwest, is being able to produce our own seed. And when there's supply chain disruptions like COVID, people couldn't get the seed that they needed for their gardens. And, you know, we want people to be able to grow their own food and have successful gardens. And so, you know, the other thing is producing on contract for larger companies. We are personally still doing that and get paid the same amount for a pound of tomato seed that we did in 2018. And so we're trying to kind of break that pattern in the industry and say, we want this to be worth your time, worth your while. And of course, cost of production has gone up a lot. Cost of labor has gone up a lot. And so we want to pay accordingly.
That makes a lot of sense. If your product price hasn't increased in 8 years, I can certainly say that your cost of production has. So it would be just really an economy of scale at that point. You have to get to a point where you're big enough to absorb those increases in material and increases in supplies for your business. And, you know, I think that's not what you're wanting to do. And honestly, it wouldn't really work out here in the Driftless to try and do that either. I don't know if you'd be able to produce enough seed to operate at that scale. We do have to take a short break here for a station identification. You are listening to the Crawford Stewardship Podcast on WDRT 91.9 FM, radio from the Driftless. Today, we are sitting down here with Dylan Bruce, the co-founder, owner, and producer for Driftless Seed Supply, based out of Viroqua, Wisconsin here. And to listen to this episode and many other episodes, you can go on to WDRT.org to find this podcast and other podcasts like it. So, Dylan, I wanted to talk a little bit more about how the business is really affecting the community that it's based in. And you're talking about these farms that aren't just based here in Viroqua. And in fact, your partner's farm in southeast Minnesota is still on a local scale, but maybe a little bit wider than I had originally thought that Driftless Seed Supply was. But what does a company like yours, even if it's not in the seed industry, but what does a company like yours bring to the local food supply that it operates in?
Well, instead of sending money outside of the community every time you purchase seed or whatever product it might be, you know, you're spending that locally, and then in turn, we're hiring folks locally to help us pack seed. We're hiring and contracting with local and regional growers. And so, yeah, it's really about keeping your food money in the community. We have a small warehouse space at the Food Enterprise Center here in Viroqua. That's a shared warehouse where there's a lot of other cool food businesses based there, and we're part of that community, and we work with folks there to pack seed. So we have a number of sort of seasonal folks that'll come in for our seed packing season, which is really like kind of December through May, when we're filling packets and getting packets sent out, getting seed racks sent out throughout the region. We're trying to hire, you know, keep the money in our community, hiring local folks rather than, like some other seed companies might do, hiring a co-packer in some other state or region to actually fill the packets.
So it's not a foreign concept. I mean, myself as a cattle producer, every time I can, I try and go to the local butcher shop to buy meat. One, because it's just plain tastes better, and two, honestly, the price isn't that big of a difference. And to me, I've always seen that as, you know, if it's $9 a pound versus $8 a pound, am I getting an extra dollar's worth of value out of that? I think absolutely yes. You know, I'm giving that 12%. That premium is actually supporting a local business, which is supporting a local producer, which in turn that producer is supporting the hardware store, the veterinarians, the feed mill.
That's right.
So like that dollar isn't, you know, just thus charged, getting charged more for a product. It is it's kind of like a tax return, really. Like, that's the value that is returned to the community, and you get a better product.
Yeah, and a big goal that we have as well is getting people to think about the value of the seeds. And again, not just buying the cheapest seeds available, but what is your return on investment on those seeds? And making sure that you're getting something that not only has high germination, but is also going to perform well in our climate and taste good when you harvest it. So there's kind of a classic joke that floats around the gardening community about you spend $200 on gardening supplies to produce $4 worth of tomatoes. And that can be true to a certain extent, but you know, anything has a learning curve. And in reality, you can do it really cheaply. You don't have to get the fanciest raised bed gardens. I do encourage folks to get soil tests through the UW Extension, and you can just Google that to find the links and instructions of that. But just, you know, one, to know what's in your soil, and if you have an old home and you're gardening near your home or old buildings, making sure there's not lead in the soil from lead paint is important. But when you kind of crack when you get your green thumb and you crack that puzzle and finally you're not just producing $4 of tomatoes, but you're producing 60 pounds of tomatoes, that's a really good feeling. And I think particularly for, you know, anyone who finds their life too full and too busy, which we all often do, spending some peaceful time out in the garden, getting your hands in the dirt, is really rewarding and even therapeutic, I would say. And so it's a good opportunity to you know, check out, spend some time outside. Whenever we do events, we always give free seed packets to kids of something like a snap pea or a cherry tomato or whatever they like best that, you know, they can just snack on right out of the garden. Because getting kids to spend time outside and spend time in the garden and really see that, you're reaping the fruits of your labor, right? You're really, it's very rewarding to take something from seed to harvest and put it on your table at the end of the day.
I would say this past summer was the first time that I had actually, I'm a great garden planter. I've never been much of a garden maintainer and harvester, but this year I finally took it over and just said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go out there and make sure that this goes from planting all the way to harvest, and then after that I handed it off to my mom for the canning and preserving and trying to learn how to do that as well. But baby steps.
Yeah, and you know, tomatoes are kind of an interesting example because they're one of the harder things to grow. They can be susceptible to diseases. They often need trellising or some type of support staking to keep the plant up off of the ground so it doesn't get too diseased or prone to pests. But there's really easy things to start with as well. And we always encourage folks, whenever possible, to just direct seed and not start stuff inside as transplants. So direct seeding, meaning just putting that seed right out into the garden where you want the plant to end up. And honestly, a lot of things actually do better that way than buying starts or starting something inside. So, you know, anything in that cucurbit family, the squash, cucumbers, things like that, just stick that seed right in the ground when it's, you know, warmed up and the soil's, you know, above 60 degrees, kind of late June. Just stick the seed in the ground, maybe two seeds in one spot, whatever spacing you want to end up with. And then if they both come up, great. You just thin it down to one plant so your garden doesn't get too crowded. So yeah, those flowers, greens, herbs, a lot of that stuff you can just seed right out in the garden. If you do want to start stuff inside, it's really, really important that it has enough light. So we're all tempted often to just start a tray of seeds in, you know, on a windowsill, and that often isn't going to cut it. You really need a grow light that has enough output to, you know, really mimic sun and the intensity of sunlight. So if you're seeing your transplants inside get really spindly and they're kind of reaching for the light, the length in between the branches or leaves starts to really stretch out, that's a sign that they don't have enough light. And we often encourage folks to just, you know, scrap it and start them again. Or maybe, you know, this year you buy those transplants at a local nursery and try again next year. But if you plant out a weak plant to start with, it's going to just struggle to get a foothold and be resilient to pests and diseases. And so, again, that's another reason that we always encourage folks to plant directly outside, right in the ground, in a spot where there's enough sunlight.
That has been my... That's been my experience. Is anytime we've ever tried to start seeds, it's always been, you know, you get 12-inch tall seeds that are maybe 2 millimeters thick. Like the stems are just super, super thin. As soon as you put them outside in any sort of wind, they get knocked over, and then you just go to the store and buy the buy the trays. So we are coming up here pretty close to the end of the radio portion of this, but. You got a little bit of a taste of what we're going to dive into in the online portion, in more gardening kind of tips and tricks and some maybe frequently asked questions and some things that you can try and avoid so you don't have to learn lessons the hard way like most folks do. But you have been listening to the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. I'm your host, Joseph Childs. We've sat down here today with Dylan Bruce, co-founder, owner, and producer for Driftless Seed Supply based out of Viroqua, Wisconsin. You can find this episode on WDRT.org if you want to follow along for the rest of this, and other archival episodes are available there as well. Thank you for listening. So welcome to the online portion of the podcast. So Dylan and I are going to continue the conversation here because we wanted to get a little bit more into some garden planning conversation, as well as some maybe tips and tricks and some frequent mistakes maybe that Dylan either made himself or maybe sees in beginning producers. And hopefully we can help you avoid that and get ready to plant your first garden or your 50th garden this spring. So Dylan, we talked a little bit about the garden planning, and I had shared with you like that is, for me, that is the really fun part, is when you walk into the store and you just go, ooh, I want that one, and I want that one, and I want that one. And I never plan, ever. I just go into the store, and I see seeds, and I go, hey, that'd be cool. Let's do a garden this year. So what are some things that you can, you know, avoid having the dread later where you're like, oh, my God, I've got 25 seed packets, and my garden isn't big enough, so what should I do here?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd say one thing we always like to joke about as well is seeds aren't just for planting, they're also for collecting. So most gardeners, I think, have that big bin of seeds, and some of us have seeds that are 10, 15 years old sitting in there. So don't be too hard on yourself if that happens. It happens to all of us. And you know, you can come around and plant them later, because, you know, a lot of people don't realize that seeds can actually last quite a long time. There's a few exceptions, so in particular, allium seeds, so that's going to be onions, leeks, chives, things like that, generally don't last very long, and their viability, their germination will decline pretty rapidly after just a couple years. But a lot of other crop categories, things like tomatoes and squash seeds, even seeds for some greens, can last pretty well for 5 years. So if you have a lot of seeds, the most important thing is that you're keeping them stored in some place that is cool and dry and dark. And that will really preserve the longevity of those seeds. If seeds are dry enough, they can also be frozen, and that'll preserve them even better. And so, like, for instance, those allium seeds, the onion seeds, if they're plenty dry, you can chuck that packet in a sealed bag or jar into the freezer, and they'll stay viable and have high germination. One thing to look out for with old seeds is that even if the germination is still there, there's really two components. It's not just the germination, which is the viability. There's also vigor to consider. And so vigor of the plants will also decline kind of in parallel oftentimes with how the viability or germination is declining. But they might still come up, but then the plant is just going to be a little weaker. And that stage of when the plant is just starting out is really important. And so we talked about what happens when you get the leggy, stretched out transplants and how those can be weak and make it difficult when you plant out, and they might be more susceptible to wind damage or to pests or things like that. And that'll also happen if the vigor of the plant is just low, if the seed is too old. So also, you know, don't worry if you need to buy a new packet of something, because again, like we were talking about earlier, it's, you know, think of that return on investment of having a more enjoyable garden experience and those sort of non-material value components, but also just better production and getting more food onto the table. So yeah, so I, you know, that's one thing in terms of seeds and you know, buying too many seeds, but it is important to think about the garden space that you have available. And again, it's really tempting to crowd stuff in, to really pack stuff in. There's a trend out there called square foot gardening, and you know, that might work in some drier climates. They're kind of planting specifications or recommendations, but for us here, it's really important to plant stuff spaced widely apart. And so, you know, tomatoes, some seed companies will say plant them 12 inches apart, plant them 1 foot apart. we plant ours 2 to 3 feet apart to just give them plenty of breathing room. And that really goes for anything. You know, if you want to grow a nice big carrot or you know, good round, nicely shaped radishes, give them space. And so that, you know, if those things that are direct seeded, you might sprinkle in lettuce seed or carrot seed to plant it. And you need to go back after it has germinated at the stage where it has maybe one or two sets of true leaves and thin it out. So when a seed first germinates, it's just going to have those cotyledons, its initial little food stores of energy that its little solar panels that it puts out to give it enough energy to grow the true leaves. And when you see the true leaves, that's when you come out and thin stuff out. And really look at the recommendations that you know, the packet has on it for spacing. But I tend to use, you know, my thumb as a rule of you know, space the carrots at least a thumb width apart. And so, you know, you don't have to be too careful. You don't need to go out there with a ruler and get stuff exact. So just have fun and be relaxed about it. Don't worry too much if there's, you know, a few weeds here and there. We like to think about not weed control, but weed management. And so just making sure that you're giving the plants, your crops, a head start over the weeds. So it's most important to keep your garden beds clean at the beginning when those plants are still small, because weeds will grow really fast and they can, you know, end up outpacing the crop. But if the crop gets ahead of the weeds enough, then it'll kind of create its own little buffer zone where it'll reduce the germination of the weed seeds that might be there, because it's you know, able to sort of monopolize the nutrients and the light as well. And so crops like larger crops like sweet corn or tomatoes or peppers, those things will canopy, which means the leaves between the different rows will sort of reach each other and start shading out the dirt and reducing the germination of weeds. And at that point, once your crops are really fruiting, you can be a little bit more lax about your weeding. So, you know, if you're a messy gardener, that's okay. That's okay to be a messy gardener. If you like to keep it neat and pin straight rows, then that's great as well. We also like to think when we're garden planning about what we call rotation, which is making sure that the crops, the different crop families, are planted in different spots year to year. And that can be a little bit difficult when you have a small garden, when you're working with a small garden space. But even if you have just one 4x8 raised bed or something, plant the tomatoes on that side this year and on the other side next year. And, you know, even little things like that make a little bit of difference.
What does that do specifically? Why is that a recommendation?
Well, it's a recommendation for two reasons. One is that a lot of diseases can be persistent in the soil. And so on a farm scale, and if it's possible in the garden setup that you have, separating your rotation by even up to 4 years can be really helpful, because a lot of diseases, the spores might remain viable in the soil for up to 4 years or so. And so if you rotate your tomatoes around and plant them in soil that hasn't had tomatoes or peppers for 4 years, they're going to generally do better and be healthier. It also is important because different crop families will consume different amounts of various nutrients. And so some things like tomatoes might be a really heavy feeder for nitrogen, and watermelons might be a heavy feeder for potassium. And so it helps sort of balance the soil, especially if you're just kind of using a generic garden fertilizer that has sort of generalized recommendations, because really those crops need pretty different amounts of nutrients. And you know, it's also important to not over fertilize when you're thinking about your soil fertility. That's why it's really nice to use that soil testing service that's available through the UW Extension, because they'll also give you recommendations for the amount of fertilizer to apply for different crops. And so you can, when you fill out that soil sample submission form, it'll give you a chance to say what crops you're going to grow. And you can say, I'm going to grow tomatoes, and then cabbage, and then cucumbers, and then come back to tomatoes. And it'll give you, you know, those 4 years worth of recommendations. And so you don't need to do that soil sample every year necessarily, but it really helps you know what a starting point is. There's also services available for if you're having trouble with producing a certain crop, if you're seeing a lot of yellowing of leaves or something like that, and you're having a hard time troubleshooting it. You can use the Ask an Extension Agent service online, or you can even send in a sample of the leaf tissue, and they can you know, say, okay, this is the nutrient levels in it. We also are really lucky to have a great vegetable pathology program, vegetable disease program at UW and UW Extension. We have a plant disease diagnostic clinic, and you can submit samples for a pretty affordable rate, and they'll tell you what disease you have, how to manage it, what tools or pesticides you can use to manage that disease, and also give you a better starting point and information about, okay, is this going to be persistent in the soil, like some things in are, like anthracnose, let's say, or white mold can be really persistent in the soil. Some things just blow in. So when we get late blight in the Midwest on tomatoes, which is really devastating for tomatoes and potatoes, that's actually blowing in on storms usually. And generally, but not always, generally isn't too persistent in the soil, versus things like Septoria leaf blight, leaf spot, which we also get on tomatoes here, and that is persistent in the soil. So it kind of lets you know what you're working with.
I had no idea there were that many, you know, resources that are directly, very, instead of just offering information, it's a direct service that they're offering through UW and Extension. I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, we've got a little bit of the garden planning side done, and I want to ask if there are some common mistakes or maybe frequently asked questions or hurdles that you faced as a beginning gardener. I know you've been doing it for quite some time, but what are some of the things that if someone would have came along and said, hey, I know you've got this idea to do this, but it's not really going to work out, just kind of go over this way, or maybe even, hey, here's a tip that I wish I would have known, or that you see people kind of making a mistake on in their early career as a gardener or even as a production agricultural farm.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we've talked about a couple of them. I think, you know, kind of starting at the beginning with the planning, just the overcrowding is kind of a common issue, and I do it too still. I'm still sometimes tempted to I'll squeeze one more plant in here, but really you're going to have a better experience if you give your plants plenty of space. I think, you know, another one that can be frustrating is the weed control. And so using landscape fabric, and especially the tougher woven ground cover, and burning or cutting holes into that to plant into can make it a lot easier for crops like tomatoes that also or melons or squash, that not only can it be a little more challenging to control the weeds around them than, say, lettuce or something like that, but they also really like heat. And especially at the beginning of the season and the ends of the season, that can be challenging here. And that black woven ground cover helps the soil heat up, and so it's going to make that crop healthier. So I would say that's one, you know, sort of trick for both making weed control easier and improving heat.
that's something that that has kind of taken me some time to get back into gardening, because that was my parents grew almost a quarter to a half acre garden every year growing up, and we had a lot of stuff, but it was, to me, it was just like, I hate weeding. I don't want to go out and do it. I don't like picking the beans. And it was just like, it was chores for me at that age.
That's right.
And now, last year was the first time that I was able to actually see it all the way through. And I had spent many of hours, laying in the garden, picking weeds. And it did become therapeutic after a while. But to get the ambition to go out and you're looking at this field of weeds at some points in the summer, that was something that really held me back from wanting to get back in. And I imagine that's what a lot of folks are like, I just don't have the energy to do this. So
yeah,
that's
good,
a great tip.
Good to look at it as just a peaceful activity, zen and the art of weed management, to just get out there, spend a little bit of time each day in the garden weeding. Another big thing besides the sort of preventative measures like the ground cover is to weed early and often, because when weeds are really small, they're just so much easier to control. And so UW Extension and crop producers will also talk about in organic production about controlling weeds at what we call the white thread stage, which is really when they're just barely germinating in the soil, because at that stage you can take a rake or a hoe out to the garden and just make a super quick pass, and just disrupting the soil a little bit is enough to knock those weeds down or knock them back, versus if you let that pigweed or the lamb's quarters get 3 or 5 feet high, then it's kind of a bear to get out there and control it. So yeah, early and often helps a lot too.
That was, I think I might have had the best bumper crop of pigweed this side of the Mississippi this year, as if we just broke the garden ground this year.
Yeah.
And so it was first year that, we've broken that sod up. It's been pasture for decades. And so it was immediately the pigweed moved in.
Yep.
And it was aggressive, taproots going down quite some ways.
Yeah, and so it's important to get at it before they get to that stage. It's also important because doing it early and often can help prevent infestation from perennial weeds that become a real pain, like quack grass or Canada thistle. No one likes poking their hand on Canada thistle every time you go to harvest your pepper, and so making sure you are just taking those preventative measures is really important. In general, for organic gardening and organic farming, we really have preventative tools in our toolbox. We're not going to, there's not the same types of fixes as we get with conventional fungicides or herbicides. And so, being preventative about your weed management is important, but also about your pest and disease management. And so things like covering a crop can help, and so using netting to control the access that bugs have. You can go online, just get mosquito netting. It doesn't have to be super fancy, crop netting or something. But throwing that over your broccoli, kale, and cabbage crops to prevent cabbage loopers or the little caterpillars that'll eat them from getting on there is a much nicer experience than having to spray a pesticide to kill them. But if you do need to, just stop in and to a local hardware store and talk to them, show them a picture of your problem that you're dealing with, and generally they'll have great resources. If they don't have a solution or idea for you, contact Extension. Again, we've got a great vegetable pathology program, plant disease diagnostic clinic at UW, and a great vegetable entomology program. And so you can send in pictures of a bug or pictures of plant diseases, and they'll get back to you about, what it is, what you can do about it.
That's I wish we'd have had that growing up, because I always felt weird, it's sprinkling the powder on the plants and stuff like that. It's like, I'm going to eat that in a couple months. And it says right here, don't ingest it. And there's like skull and crossbones on it.
And for that reason, if you spray BT, which is a pretty innocuous and certified organic pesticide for Lepidopteran pests, the cabbage moths, cabbage loopers, those things, you know, it's still important to wash it. Same with spraying things preventatively on your tomatoes to help manage disease. We really like to use a product called C's. There's also a product out there called Serenade, I think it is, but they're different preparations of bacteria that form symbiotic relationships with the plants and actually help the plant upregulate its immune system. So we don't think about plants having immune systems the same way as we do often, but they do. And so it'll help the plant react better to stressors, and it often will just help them grow faster. It's just, you know, because they evolved to have these relationships with these bacterium or with different fungi. And so, you know, using those products preventatively ahead of time will help the plant be more resilient to both those biotic stressors like pests and diseases, as well as abiotic stressors like drought or lack of nutrient access.
Well, Dylan, we've got about 5 minutes here, and I do want to continue talking. I want to get one or two more, like a frequently asked question that you might get from folks, or something that, you know, a tip that you would say before you go out and plant this spring, or before you start your plants, or whatever you're going to do this spring, or maybe if you're on the fence about even having a garden. What's something that you would give the folks that are maybe on the fence or they've been in it a couple of years and they're not getting the results that they're looking for, so they're maybe thinking about not doing it again this year?
Yeah, well, I would encourage everyone to try gardening each year, of course. I think one thing is, like, if you're struggling with in-ground growing and having a hard time with that, try planting something in a grow bag or a container, because that can just be a little easier. If you've been having disease on your cucumbers or disease on your tomatoes every year, try doing it in a container. It'll mean you have to water more often and probably fertilize a little bit throughout the season, but you're going to be starting with a clean slate in terms of those diseases that are in the soil. So, you know, that's one thing to consider. Another question we get a lot of times is, what can I plant in the shade? Don't plant your tomatoes in the shade. Don't plant your watermelon or squash in the shade. You know, there are those things that really need full sun. If you have I should back up a little bit. Full shade is really hard to grow most of our food crops and a lot of common sort of cut bouquet flowers in. Dappled shade, partial shade, you can get away with some stuff. If you have partial shade, things that are smaller plants are generally going to do a little bit better. Green, leafy greens, herbs, those things will often do a little bit better. But it's important to remember that things in shade are going to grow bigger leaves, they're going to have bigger surface area, and they'll stretch out a little bit more looking for the light like we talked about earlier, and both of those things are going to make them a little bit more susceptible to pests and diseases because they're just a little bit more juicy and soft for and, you know, easier to get to. And so don't be surprised if you know, if you plant things in both sun and shade, if the shade things are getting hit by bugs that the sun ones aren't. But yeah, things like basil and lettuce and those things are generally work pretty well in the shade, or, you know, in partial shade or in the understory of other crops. And so if you let your tomatoes get established, you know, planting basil on the north side of your row of tomatoes can be an option to make good use of that space, or planting spinach on the north side of your row of peas. Or something like that, you know, you can kind of stack, and you know, things can do okay in the shade, and it'll actually help them keep cool as well.
That was something that I found endlessly fascinating, and it made planting my garden really difficult, but it was very rewarding once I figured out the puzzle was companion planting. I went down a large rabbit hole of every single thing that I bought. I'm like, what should I plant with this? and what helps it, what deters pests, what can't I plant next to each other. And it really is a puzzle, because once you start laying it out, you're like, well, I can't put that next to that, because they'll either cross-pollinate or they just don't like each other, or they both use the same nutrient. And so it's really a puzzle to figure out, and it was really fun, but it took a while.
There is some of those recommendations out there about companion planting. There is some stuff that's not super well backed up by research, but there is other stuff that, like you're saying, makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, having a diverse garden bed is going to do a couple things for you. It's going to, like you said, they're not going to be competing as readily for the same nutrients. It makes it harder for the pests to find the plant that they like, versus if you have everything in one block, it's going to be a little bit easier for the pest to just find and then move from plant to plant to plant. Now, keep in mind that there's a trade-off with the sort of crop rotation that we talked about earlier, where if you plant things in blocks or groups of a family, then it's easier to manage that rotation. But you can do a little bit of both, right? Like, you can interplant some flowers with certain crops, and that's going to bring in pollinators. It'll bring in beneficial insects that might help control your pests.
I know my mom always swore by marigolds. We always kept marigolds at the end of every row, and that was for, I believe, rabbits and other stuff not to be chewing on our plants. But
yeah, marigolds smell strongly, and so they will keep away some things.
And that was I believe another thing I did this year, especially with the transplanted seedlings from the store that I bought, was ground red pepper. Plastered that all over those leafy greens at the very beginning, and then all around it, and it just did nothing.
Helped deter the rabbits.
Nothing got chewed on, so that was really good. We are running a little bit short on time here, and I do want to eventually come back, and we'll do another episode. Maybe towards harvest time, or
we could do a seed saving episode.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I appreciate you stopping in, Dylan. You've been a friend of this show as well as the other show, Digging Deep, and been on a couple of different episodes. So I appreciate you coming in, and a very timely topic, and maybe a little bit more uplifting and fun thing to talk about. That's with all the stuff that's going on in our world today. We can talk about good food and good communities and having some peaceful zen of weeding the garden talk.
That's right.
So I appreciate you coming in, Dylan. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.